It's nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT. On 100.1 FM, it's your public radio station. Broadcasting from sunny Kodiak, Alaska, where it's 60 degrees, looking for a high of 61 today. These sunny skies are expected to go on through tonight and tomorrow. Easterly winds to 5 will come down to nothing and then turn to the south tomorrow, come up to 10. Coming up on the Midday Report, the Alaska House of Representatives was able to agree enough yesterday to avoid a state government shutdown. Efforts are underway to build electric vehicle charging stations along the rail belt. And Alaska's three largest airports have been hubs for giving out the COVID-19 vaccine, too. Those stories and more after national headlines.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Teams of rescuers, including those from Israel and Mexico, are facing another evening of carefully navigating the unstable terrain of twisted metal and concrete slabs of what used to be beachfront homes at the Champlain Tower South Building in Surfside, Florida. At least 11 people are confirmed dead since the condos north of Miami caved in last week during the early morning hours while many residents slept. About 150 are still unaccounted for. In his update to the public this afternoon, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis spoke of the victims and their families.
The families, we're going to be there for the long haul on this. And we're just not going to look back, and we're going to be there with any support that we can provide.
Officials say Florida prosecutors will seek a grand jury investigation. NPR's Asma Khalid reports President Biden and the First Lady are expected to travel to Surfside in the coming days.
Biden's visit to the beachside community near Miami comes a week after the 12-story condo building partially collapsed. The White House says the trip is being coordinated to avoid drawing away any critical local resources that are needed in the ongoing search and rescue effort. The president intends to thank first responders and comfort families who continue to wait for news about their loved ones. The White House says he also wants to ensure that officials there have the federal resources they need in the moment. Biden has dispatched the head of FEMA down to Florida. The administration says it has more than 50 personnel on the ground working with state and local officials. Asma Khalid, NPR News.
Months before the building partially collapsed, the president of the condo board informed residents about rapidly deteriorating structural damage identified during an inspection in 2018. The letter was first reported by the Wall Street Journal. An NPR investigation finds low-income disaster survivors are less likely to receive some types of crucial disaster assistance. NPR's Rebecca Hirsch reports the federal government has been aware of the disparity since at least 2019.
After a hurricane, wildfire, or other disaster, many people rely on the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, for help. But poor people are less likely to receive some types of basic housing assistance after disasters. That's according to internal analyses conducted by FEMA and obtained by NPR through a public records request. As a result, low-income disaster survivors often struggle to find stable housing and are more likely to be displaced or face long-term health and financial impacts. FEMA says providing equitable assistance is a top priority. The agency is seeking feedback about how its programs serve people of different demographics. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
American tennis superstar Serena Williams is out of Wimbledon. She was unable to continue playing today after she hurt her leg in an opening round match against Belarusian Alexandra Sasnovic. Williams fought back tears as she walked to the net to concede with a score 3-all. You're listening to NPR News.
NPR News is brought to you in part by Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. For an appointment or more information, 481-2400.
Yesterday, the Alaska House of Representatives voted to allow its budget bill to go into effect on July 1st, averting a state government shutdown. Governor Mike Dunleavy said he is reviewing the budget for individual line items he could veto, but that the vote means he can now prepare the budget to be implemented. House Speaker Louise Stutes said the vote will be a relief to many.
We've got a lot of Alaskans that are probably jumping for joy about now, thinking that their paychecks are going to continue on coming.
Yesterday, Wasilla Representative Kathy Tilton changed her vote for the budget to take effect at the start of the budget year after voting against it earlier this month. Tilton is the leader of the Republican House Minority Caucus. She said there's still much work left to do to fix the state's structural budget problem.
I would not say that it is a win or a victory. I believe that it is a beginning and a start.
The budget vote will allow the vast majority of state services to continue, but some programs would stop at least temporarily. They include programs to reduce the cost of energy in high-cost regions and to provide academic scholarships and need-based grants for college students. It also leaves the current level of this year's permanent fund dividend at $525. Legislators from all four caucuses have said they want to reach an agreement that would allow these programs to resume and for the PFD to be higher. But there are differences over what it would take to reach an agreement. Three-quarters of both chambers must vote to fund these programs from a separate savings account called the Constitutional Budget Reserve. The House also passed a motion supporting a launch of a working group to recommend changes that would lead to a long-term balanced budget. It would include both members of the House and Senate. The motion said the group would hold at least two public meetings and make recommendations before the next special session. Dunleavy has called another special session to begin on August 2nd. Both chambers voted to adjourn the current special session, which lasted 6 days. The vote to avoid a shutdown came after some minority caucus Republican members expressed concern that the majority wasn't upholding an agreement between Stutes and Tilton. Stutes, a Kodiak Republican, said there was a lack of communication over whether she and Tilton had reached an agreement on the votes. She credited Tilton with working to resolve their differences. Dunleavy, a Republican, said on June 17th that without a different outcome, much of the state government would have shut down on July 1st. Members of the mostly Democratic House majority disagreed with his interpretation of the state constitution. The Dunleavy administration then sued over the disagreement. Oral arguments on that lawsuit are scheduled for today. Efforts are underway to build a network of electric vehicle charging stations along the rail belt. As KUAC's Dan Brose reports, state and private grants are boosting to push as much more Alaskans are driving EVs and need places to charge their batteries on the roads between Fairbanks, Anchorage, and the Kenai.
The Alaska Energy Authority recently announced the award of grants totaling $1 million to help rail belt businesses and other entities install electric vehicle chargers. The 9 grant recipients range from the Chamber of Commerce in Seward to the Three Bears Grocery Store in Healy. AEA Executive Director Curtis Thayer says the state agency aims to help make long-distance travel along the rail belt corridor more viable for electric vehicles.
You know, if you want to drive from Homer to Fairbanks, right now you can't do it. But we're hoping by this time next year that you will be able to drive from Anchorage to Fairbanks and charge your vehicle along the way.
The AEA EV Charger Grant Program is funded by Alaska's share of a Volkswagen emissions settlement. Thayer says the VW money provides a way to jumpstart installation of EV chargers.
I don't think in the long run this is really a government program or something that the government necessarily should be involved in. But with this initial funding that we had and the need and the interest of electrical vehicles, we wanted to make sure people know that it could be done and they can use electrical vehicles for that 600-mile distance.
Thayer notes that the grant recipients must pay a portion of the cost of installing their EV charger.
There was over another $500,000 total that was matching. So you have a lot of these grantees put up a lot of their personal funds to match these grants to be competitive. So I think a lot of people realize it's kind of an investment in the future.
Thayer says the AEA selected grant recipients at locations between 50 and 100 miles apart, but did not get any applications north of Healy, and plans to offer additional grants targeting that last portion of the route.
We would love to find somebody in Enana or in Fairbanks.
Meanwhile, Golden Valley Electric Association is independently planning to install two EV chargers at its Fairbanks headquarters. GVEA spokesperson Meadow Bailey says the co-op is interested in expanding the availability of EV chargers around its interior service area.
We recognize that as people start to adopt this technology and have more EV vehicles, that one of the big limitations is the range they can travel.
Bailey says the co-op is also funding an independent fast charger project.
This summer, we partnered with Recharge Alaska. They are working to install a charger in Cantwell.
This, to me, is another project that needs to be done.
Recharge Alaska is the side hustle of Chris Hall of Anchorage, a North Slope oil engineer with a passion for electric vehicles.
This is the first endeavor ever for doing a DC fast charger in mainland Alaska. This is the first endeavor ever for trying to figure out how to make these things operate in the cold weather.
Once people really start seeing how good this is, you know, all the gas stations will have DC fast chargers. It's no big deal, you know.
Hall's friend and fellow EV enthusiast Kirk Martakis runs Driving on Sunshine charging station in Cantwell, where he produces and sells solar energy to EV drivers. Martakis says the 75-kilowatt fast charger he and Hall plan to install with the Golden Valley grant money will be 5 times faster than his current units, and he anticipates it'll boost already growing demand.
Last year, we saw a tripling of the number of vehicles that stopped in, and this year, we're looking at doubling it. And most everybody who comes and charges here are so grateful that somebody has stepped up to the plate to allow for them to be able to travel from Fairbanks to Anchorage and to the Kenai.
Martakis and Hall both emphasize that the Golden Valley supported project is as much about providing a fast charging option as field testing the technology in the interior. Everyone involved in advancing EV charging access points to regulatory hurdles that need to be surmounted, and the Regulatory Commission of Alaska is currently considering changes to better accommodate EV charging stations. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Sites at Alaska's three largest airports have given out more than 1,300 doses of COVID-19 vaccine. That's according to data for the first few weeks of the state's program to get Alaskans and travelers vaccinated at airports in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau. So far, many of the people opting to get the shot at the airports are Alaska residents, says Terry O'Connor, deputy director of the state's Division of Public Health. O'Connor says that's not surprising.
I think we know that Alaskans use air travel to do probably more than residents of many other states, right? And we use it for both, you know, travel for pleasure, but also for necessities, right? Alaskans use airports to get to work. They use it to access medical care, you know, shopping for necessities, like all sorts of things.
Also, O'Connor says the airport sites are open later, and people headed into the airports for their shots don't have to pay for parking. As for which vaccine is in demand, O'Connor says most people want a shot of the two-dose Pfizer vaccine.
It looks like about 10% of the folks getting vaccinated at the airport sites are in that 12 to 16 age range, so that's the only one they can get. And then, you know, it also seems like, just anecdotally, I've heard a little bit about people who are coming from maybe other countries, like they're more familiar maybe with the Pfizer.
O'Connor says it's difficult to say the number of shots distributed compared to expectations, because the health department has never had a vaccination program quite like this one.
Honestly, through this whole pandemic, it's like, it's hard to have expectations because so much of it is just, it's like we've never done this before.
While the health department is bracing for more travelers to come through Alaska airports in July, O'Connor says it's unclear how many will need a shot, especially since the vaccine is so widely available in other states. For now, O'Connor expects the airport vaccine sites to run through the winter, but she says the program could change with demand. As of yesterday, half of Alaskans aged 12 and up were fully vaccinated. A deadly fungus could threaten several amphibian species in the Tongass National Forest. On Mitkoff Island, the U.S. Forest Service is using a mix of old and new methods to find it. Katie Anastas tagged along to visit one testing site and has this report.
About 3 miles inland, the Twin Creek Ski Shelter overlooks a pond in the middle of the Muskeg. Just a few weeks ago, this part of the island was still covered in snow. Today, members of the U.S. Forest Service are here to look for frogs. They scoop up buckets of water from different parts of the pond. Then Marcy Mainhart pours the water into a pump that carries it through a filter.
This filter collects all of the environmental DNA, the eDNA. It collects it all here. So then we'll take a sanitary tweezer and collect the filter from inside here, put it into a sanitary bag, label it with where we are and how much water was sent through it, and then we'll send that back to the lab.
The filters look like round cotton pads. They're sending about 3 dozen of them to a lab for DNA testing. The results will tell them 2 things. First, whether there are amphibians at the sites. And second, whether pathogens like chytrid fungus are there too. Eric Castro is the fish biologist at the Petersburg Ranger District, leading the effort to test for chytrid on Mitkoff Island.
Then we get to send all the samples into the lab.
We'll get our numbers.
And then, you know, hold our fingers crossed that we don't find chytrid.
We want to see yes, amphibians, no pathogens. That's our hope.
Chytrid is a skin fungus. Frogs and salamanders absorb oxygen through their skin, and the fungus hampers their ability to do that. That reduces their energy level and often kills them. Last year, the Tongass Wildlife and Fisheries Program detected chytrid in Wrangell, Prince of Wales Island, and Yakutat.
It's serious to try and locate these areas that are contaminated because it stops them from being able to reproduce, or if they are able to reproduce, then usually that young won't be able to reproduce. So it kind of snips their genetic timeline just in the bud.
1 out of every 16 amphibian species has gone extinct or become endangered because of chytrid fungus, according to a 2019 study. Global trade is thought to have brought it to Alaska from other parts of the world. There are 3 frog and 3 salamander species native to the Tongass. The Forest Service says they're a vital part of the food chain. They eat a range of insects and other invertebrates, and they're prey for many fish, birds, and small mammals. Castro says the agency has very little baseline information about the size and location of existing amphibian populations.
If we don't know how many exist, all we have is anecdotal evidence. You know, folks say they used to see more frogs in this area, you know, back when they were young, but there's no data.
To collect that data, Castro and his team have visited 12 different sites, 2 times each. While Castro and Mainhart collect and filter water, Sam Winesma is using a different tool, his eyes. At each site, a member of the team always looks around the old-fashioned way.
It's essentially what you do when you're 12. You go look at the edge of ponds and streams and flip over logs looking for frogs and toads and newts. Occasionally, and then I write down anything that I find. I do that for 50 meters along the edge of this pond.
Castro thinks he saw salamander eggs on an earlier site visit. Thanks to the DNA tests, he'll soon know for sure.
That's the power of this environmental DNA. These are elusive creatures, and pathogens being microscopic are even more so. But, you know, with the environmental DNA, that really enables us to be able to see what we can't actually.
The Petersburg Ranger District will have to wait 1 to 3 months to get the test results back. But they're already thinking about ways the public can help stop the spread of the fungus. One idea is setting up boot washing stations at sites where chytrid is detected. Castro, Mainhart, and Winesma clean their boots with a solution of bleach and water after visiting each site to avoid contaminating other parts of the forest. Castro hopes the project brings more attention to a group of animals that often goes unseen.
When they're out of sight, out of mind, you know, and you oftentimes, considering the fisheries resources first, and regardless of them not being the charismatic species that we see, you know, that climb trees and howl at the moon, they're part of the natural environment.
A part of the environment that hopefully is here to stay. In Petersburg, I'm Katie Anastas.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. A Skipper Science phone app adds fishermen's real-life data to decision-making. More after this.
Fish Radio is brought to you by Alaska Boats and Permits in Homer, marine broker for vessels, permits, and IFQs, online at alaskaboat.com.
Fishermen are the eyes and ears of a changing ocean ecosystem. Now their observations can be added to Alaska's science and data-driven resource management. A new Skipper Science smartphone app lets fishermen collect and share what they're seeing in real time. The free app is an offshoot of an Indigenous Sentinels network started nearly 20 years ago at St. Paul Island in the Pribilofs to monitor wildlife and environmental conditions in the Bering Sea.
There is a vast body of knowledge that fishermen hold from their experience on the water, and we have very much underutilized that knowledge for years and years and years, especially here in the North Pacific.
Lauren Devine is Director of Ecosystem Conservation for St. Paul's Tribal Government. She says fishermen are a critical source of untapped knowledge. To broaden their reach, St. Paul has partnered with Salmon State's Salmon Habitat Information Program, or SHIP, which for years has helped quantify informal observations. SHIP's outreach has shown that fishermen identify climate change as a top threat to their livelihoods and communities. Their at-sea experiences can help fill data gaps that enhance planning and ways to adapt. Real-life observations will be collected into the fall, and those voices will be brought to decision-makers. Program Manager Lindsay Bloom.
In Washington, D.C. right now, climate is a huge topic, whether it's in the infrastructure package or basically embedded in everything else going on in government right now. And fishermen want to be at the table.
Lauren Devine.
This is a real actionable way to gather the best science and the best data, and as well as and alongside of the local and traditional knowledge that provides context for all of those numbers and data.
Find the free phone app at skipperscience.org. Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Hello, this is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Kodiak. Kodiak Commercial Salmon Fishery Advisory Announcement number 11, date issued 10 a.m. on June 27th. There will be a 57-hour commercial salmon fishing period from noon Tuesday, June 29th, until 9 p.m. Thursday, July 1st, in the following areas: in the Cape Alitak, Humpy Dead Man, Alitak Bay, Mosier Bay, and Olga Bay sections of the Alitak District. Cost recovery fisheries are scheduled to begin in Spiridon Bay Special Harvest Area, also known as Telrod Cove, at 12:01 a.m. Monday, June 28th. And the Spiridon Bay Special Harvest Area will remain closed to common property fishing. Fishing opportunities in the Spiridon Bay Special Harvest Area will depend on the ability to meet KRAA cost recovery needs, and all cost recovery information may be obtained by calling 486-6559. As previously announced, the following areas remain open to commercial salmon fishing until further notice: the Outer Iakuluk section of the Southwest Kodiak District, the Inner and Outer Upper Station sections of the Alitak District, the Fowl Bay Special Harvest Area, and the Waterfall Bay Special Harvest Area. Closed waters are currently reduced until further notice in the following locations: in Inner Upper Station section of the Alitak District, waters will remain open to the stream terminus at Olga Creek at stream number 257304. In Fowl Bay, to the stream terminus at Hidden Lake Creek, stream number 251406. And in Waterfall Bay, to the stream terminus at Little Waterfall Creek, stream number 251822. And to the stream terminus at Big Waterfall Creek, stream number 251821. Fishermen are reminded that in the Kodiak area, including the mainland district, until further notice, king salmon 28 inches or greater in length may not be retained by purse seine gear in the commercial fishery and must be returned to the water unharmed. Other closed waters are shown in the Kodiak area salmon statistical chart and detailed in commercial salmon fishing regulations, and statistical charts, harvest strategies, and commercial salmon fishing regulations are available at the Kodiak Fish and Game Office, and of course the most recent salmon fishery information may be obtained by calling the department's 24-hour record of phone at 486-4559. Thank you very much. Good luck fishing. And this is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Thank you, Mr. Fish and Game. Welcome to your Island Messenger for Tuesday. It is the 29th day of June, the year 2021. The sun rose today at 5:12. It will set again at 11:13. That will give us 18 hours and 1 minute of glorious daylight, a loss of 1 minute and 13 seconds compared to yesterday. A record high for this date was 86, set in 1953, and a record low was 37, set in 2003. Currently, 57, they downgraded us to 57. We were at 60 at one point. Sunny skies this afternoon with a high near 61. Calm winds turn to the east and go to 5 miles per hour. Mostly clear skies tonight, low around 49. Calm winds, and mostly sunny skies tomorrow with a high near 61. Light and variable wind will turn to the south 10 miles per hour tomorrow. On Thursday, they are calling for some rain. Could be heavy at times. High near 54 on Thursday. Southeast wind could gust as high as 20. And that rain is expected to go on through Thursday night. Just turn into a chance of rain on Friday. Well, the Kodiak National Wildlife Visitor Center is still closed to visitors. But tomorrow at 10 a.m. to 12 p.m., and the weather's going to be beautiful, in Sargent Park, they're having an outdoor salmon camp day. And every week, in fact, at this time, 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. at Sargent Park, you can stop by for this outdoor, interactive, and self-led programming on Kodiak, Alaska's natural world. The event is open to all ages. If you want more information, just call them up at 487-0283. The City of Kodiak and the Kodiak Island Borough Cooperative Relations Committee will be holding a meeting tomorrow. That's happening at 4 p.m. in the Kodiak Public Library's multipurpose room. The meeting's open to the public, and for agendas and meeting packets, go to the City of Kodiak website. For more information, call the city clerk at 486-8636. The Borough Assembly will be having their regular meeting on Thursday. That's happening at 6:30 p.m., and they're back in the Assembly Chambers. Of course, that meeting is open to the public. On Friday, they're having the 4th of July 5K and 10K walk-run race, and you'll want to register at the pool on race day, so on Friday, at 4:30 p.m., and the new course starts at the Armory nearby at 125 Powell Street. But again, you want to register at the pool on race day, 4:30 p.m. on Friday. Chiniac 4th of July celebration is happening Sunday, the 4th of July. The parade begins at 4 p.m. It starts at, parade route is from Rhodes End to Silver Beach. And come join the fun. They're having floats, four-wheelers, bikes, horses, cars, walkers, you name it. Everyone is invited to participate or just come and watch. Dress is patriotic, red, white, and blue. And again, that's Sunday, the 4th of July, starting at 4 p.m., starting at Rhodes End. Blackwater Railroad Company is coming for a concert. Kodiak Arts Council and Lucky Pierre Productions proudly present an evening of music. That's happening at the Kodiak State Fairgrounds on Saturday, July 3rd. The gates open at 6. Music starts at 6:30. And they're having Frank Sullivan and Jillian Lee, followed by Kodiak favorites Ellamy Tiller and the Twang, and then the headliners, Blackwater Railroad Company. You can enjoy a cold beer in the beer garden and a deluxe hamburger from the grill prepared by the Kodiak Lions Club. Complete details and tickets for the concert can be found online at kodiakarts.org. That's the Kodiak Arts Council website. Alzheimer's Resource of Alaska is hosting webinars in July and August via Zoom. The next one is Thursday, July 1st from 1 to 2 p.m. about art links promoting self-expression in the form of art. Registration for the events and additional information can be found on their website at allsalaska.org. That's ALZAlaska.org.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 3 times a day. Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.